This is Mary Lee for Talking Information Radio. Reading Ellery Queen, September-October of 24. Gannets and Ghouls by Sue Parman. Last night I dreamed of Esbern Magnusson, so I wasn't surprised when a letter from his sister Tora arrived this morning. I don't believe in second sight. It's one of the things Esbern and I argued about over pints in our favorite pub, the Gannet in Goole. But as a Scot, I'd heard too many stories of premonition dreams. I was headed out from my cramped London apartment for my latest assignment when I ran into our building's postman, who handed me the letter. It felt strangely heavy, although when I ripped it open, it contained only a single sheet of paper. August 17, 1962. Dear Mr. MacLeod, my brother speaks of you often as the only friend he had at Oxford. I am writing to you with a strange but desperate request. My brother is missing. I am afraid to ask for help from the local villagers. Please do not reply to this letter, as it will most certainly be intercepted. Tora. The letter began formally but then disintegrated into a barely legible scrawl, as if written in haste. I returned immediately to my flat and began to pack. Esbern and I had shared a flat while we were undergraduates at Oxford. Although he was a first-class honors biology student, and I had barely managed a pass in English, we became good friends, sharing our reading preferences and even borrowing each other's clothes, although his taste in clothes was atrocious, so he usually borrowed mine. When he left abruptly 2 years ago because of what he described as a family emergency, he asked me to pack up his papers and send them to him, so I had his address. It was simple, just his name, Esbern Magnusson, followed by the name of the island, Mackines, in the Faroe Islands. I also had a photograph of Tora. It had fallen out of one of the books I packed for him, and I kept it. I was already a little in love with her from the way Esbern talked about her in The Gannet and Gould, but the picture put the icing on the cake. She was tall and fair like Esbern, with thick, glossy, shoulder-length hair and gray eyes that pierced the surface of the photo and went straight to my heart. In the photo, she had her arm around an older woman I assumed was her mother, and they stood beside a bed in which an old man lay, presumably her father. But what a difference between the parents. The old man looked shriveled and on the brink of death, whereas the mother glowed with life, just like her daughter. Having packed so impulsively, I now had second thoughts. I was a junior reporter for a small London newspaper. I'd gained some small success recently in writing quirky columns about birds, such as the crow that imitated the sound of a flushing toilet at a construction site. But my pay was low, my position shaky. Taking off for the Faroes would probably cost me my job. Unless I called my editor and pitched him the idea for a story that had just come into my head. I would write about gannets, I told him. The northern gannet, Morus desanthus, was the largest seabird in the North Atlantic. Between 5 and 8 pounds, an adult had a wingspan of 6 feet and was white with black wingtips. Gannets nested on ledges hundreds of feet above the sea on the high cliffs of Mykines, as well as on the island of Sulgoscir, 40 miles north of the Hebridean island of Lewis, where I was born. Called Guga in Scotland and Sula in the Faroes, the chicks were harvested by men who lowered themselves over the cliffs with ropes on a single night, Mykines, or spent 2 weeks scrambling over the cliffs armed with noose-tipped poles in Scotland. It would have all the ingredients of a front-page story, dramatic scenery, personal anecdotes about trials of manhood, and social commentary on animal cruelty versus local traditions. I myself was a Guga man. It was Gannets that had launched my friendship with Esbern. The name of our pub, the Gannet and Ghoul, had prompted our conversation when we first shared a table as strangers, although after comparing our experiences with gannet hunting, we were surprised to learn from a sign posted above the bar that the pub's gannet was not a bird, but the name of the owner. In the 18th century, a poor chimney sweep had aspired to rise above his station and own a pub, and when he succeeded, he named the pub Gannett's Goal. Goal became Ghoul during a wave of spiritualism during the 19th century when the pub sponsored seances. And today, I had joked with a raised pint, it is still a house of spirits. And Esmeron had laughed and replied, so we have gannets in common, what about ghouls? So I told him about the dreaded each usage, the water horse that lurked on Scottish moors, and he told me about Dragar. We were on our second or third pints by then. What are Dragar? I asked. You'd have to ask my sister, Tora. Tora tells the best ghost stories. Dragar are ghosts? Singular, Dragar, plural, Dragar, he said pedantically. No, not ghosts exactly. Vampires? Demons? Leprechauns? But Esmeron refused to say anything more about Dragar. In fact, he seemed increasingly uncomfortable as I bombarded him with questions. He managed to deflect my questions by bringing the topic back to Tora, who he said became furious to learn, as a child, that she was forbidden to climb the cliffs to hunt Gannett because she was a girl. Only men, true men, hunted Gannett. I shivered, remembering my fear as I scrambled over the cliffs of Sulig Skir, my hands slimy from the oil on the chick's feathers, as the sea boiled over the rocks 200 feet below. My fear of heights was unmanly and shameful, and it was one of the reasons I'd been so eager to leave the island for Oxford. The Gannett hunt on Mackines, from what Esmeron told me, was even more terrifying. The cliffs were twice the height, and men were lowered by ropes during the dark of night to slit the throats of the chicks. But of course, I wasn't planning to participate in the hunt. I wasn't even sure I would arrive in time to witness it. The window of opportunity to hunt the birds was small. The chicks must be large, but not yet able to fly, their plumage still gray-brown with white dots rather than the dazzling white with black-tipped wings of the adults. If, by some miraculous coincidence, I did arrive when the hunt was on, I would stay well away from the cliffs of Mackines and confine myself to interviews. And if I missed the hunt, I could use my history as a Guga man to win their trust. There was nothing like shared danger to inspire the sharing of confidences, such as what had happened to Esmeron Magnusson. That was my main goal, to discover why Esmeron was missing. On the boat from England to Copenhagen, where I would catch the Faroes passenger ship to the large island of Streymoy in the Faroes, I reviewed my notes about the Faroes. They consisted of 18 islands in the North Atlantic between Shetland and Iceland, tiny nubbles of basalt bashed by ocean swells, drenched by rain and eroded by winds that could top 150 miles an hour. Irish monks had visited as early as the 4th century, leaving behind sheep that the Vikings found when they arrived centuries later. Although the islands were now a self-governing part of Denmark, there were still more sheep than people. In the last census, the entire island of Mackines had only 60 people, all living in one village. I wrote a standard journalistic checklist of what I should include in my first paragraph. Who is the essay about? Esmeron Magnusson, 22-year-old first-class honors student in biology at Oxford. What happened? After 3 years at Oxford, he returned home for a family emergency and 2 years later disappeared, according to his sister. Where did he disappear? Somewhere on Mackines? Maybe. When did he disappear? About 2 weeks ago, maybe. How did he disappear? Unknown, but villagers may be involved, according to his sister. And why did he disappear? Unknown, ditto for villagers and sister. I stared at the list, dissatisfied. All I had was Tora's letter. Perhaps it was a joke, the beginning of a ghost story she mailed by mistake. But I dismissed my alarm and began to imagine my arrival on Mackines. Intrepid reporter knocks on door. Hello, Miss Magnusson. We've never met, but I knew your brother at Oxford, and you sent me a letter. Oh! Her cheeks flush. Her eyes look down demurely, then into mine with a flash of desire. The storm that had begun during the journey from England intensified as the Faroes passenger ship, the Tildur, steamed out of Copenhagen to the north. There were rumors that a Danish cargo ship bound for England, had foundered with all hands lost, and the mood on the Tiljar was dour. I was one of the few passengers still sitting in the lounge when the evening meal came to an end. A man with gray spiky hair and leathery skin asked if he could join me for an after-dinner drink, and when I invited him to sit, he introduced himself as Per Olesen from Norway. "You are English?" he asked. "Scottish. I'm on my way to visit a friend on McKines." At the name McKines, Per Olesen did something very strange. He cupped my face in his weathered palms and looked at me keenly as if inspecting a fruit for bruises. Then he sat back and said, "Shall I tell you a story?" His clothes were frayed and he hadn't shaved for a while. He reminded me of a busker on a London street corner begging for change. I hesitated, then said, "It's a good night for a story." He cleared his throat. "I once owned a fishing boat. I fished for cod in the far north. One day a storm came up and blew me far out to sea. There I found a man floating in the waves. I hauled him aboard. I expected him to be dead, but he was still alive." As Per Olesen spoke, he sat taller. His muscles rippled and his eyes focused on something far away. In a voice louder and deeper, he continued, "He wore a black oilskin jacket. Seaweed was twisted in his hair and water streamed from his mouth. He told me the date of my death. That's how I knew he was a Draeger." I felt a sudden thrill at the word Draeger. Esbern's ghoul. "What is a Draeger?" I asked. Per Olesen shrugged. "An Agenwalker, a man who doesn't die. He lives forever unless he's killed a second time and dies a final death." My heart was thudding so loud in my ears that it drowned out the sounds of the storm and the grinding roar of the ship's engines. And then from the next table I heard laughter. A party of five women were drinking coffee. One of the women said to me, "Don't listen to him. He likes to frighten the tourists." Per Olesen glared at them and said, "Be glad you will die. It's a terrible thing to live forever." Middle-aged, round-cheeked, and sturdy-looking, the woman removed her headscarf, revealing dark hair streaked with gray. "And what date did he give you for your death?" she asked him. The ship lurched and the man gripped the table. The human mind cannot accept the truth of death. Once a Draeger tells you the date, you forget it immediately. "How convenient." She turned to me and said, "Just give him a few coins and he'll leave you alone." Per Olesen shrank as she spoke. When I handed him a few shillings I had in my pocket, he staggered to his feet and stumbled from the room. The woman let out a sharp breath. "Well, that's quite enough of that for a dark and stormy night. My name is Gudra. Did I hear you say you're Scottish?" "Callum MacLeod from the island of Lewis in the Hebrides," I said. "I'm visiting a friend who lives in McKines." "Ah," her eyes brightened. "I know people there. Who is your friend?" "Esbern Magnusson. We were at university together," I said, and then stopped speaking. Although the woman looked friendly, what if they were from McKines? Why had Tora said she was afraid to ask the local villagers for help? "Esbern." She glanced at the other women. After a long moment, she said, "I knew Esbern's mother. I was very sad when she died." I thought of the vibrant woman standing beside Tora in the photograph. "She's dead?" I couldn't believe it. "She came down with pneumonia 2 weeks ago and died within a week." "That's when Esbern left university," I said. "He said it was a family emergency." Gudrid nodded slowly. He would have known something was wrong. He was her favorite. She blew her nose. She never liked it when he climbed the cliffs after the gannets. But what choice did he have? It's what men do here. Sorrow seemed to have loosened her thoughts. I was reminded of my mother, whose thoughts rambled from one topic to another when she became upset. After a few minutes of silence, the women got up and said good night. The Tjaldr arrived early the next morning in the town of Torshavn on Strømøy. By the time I walked down the gangplank, Gudrun and her friends were gone. Clouds streaked high above me, first concealing and then revealing basalt cliffs topped with green. The smell of flesh on the verge of rot hovered in the air, and then a fierce cold wind blew it away. A boat called the Albatross took me from Strømøy to the island of Vágar, from which I hope to take the final step in my journey by catching the ferry to McKinney's. The journey had taken longer than I expected and left me disoriented. Everywhere I looked, I saw menace. The steeply sloping green hills were gouged with streams, as if raked by a cat's claws. Used to heavy rains and winds in Scotland, I was stunned by the intensity of the sudden shifts in Faroese weather. When the boat pulled into the harbor of Mjøsvegur on the island of Vágur, the clouds behind the hills were tinted red by the setting sun. The sea and the town itself seemed coated with blood, and gouts of crimson coated the rocks. I spent an uneasy night there and set off the next morning, glad to be on the road despite the rain. Although it was only a few miles walk over the island to reach the port of Sævar, it took me all day. I lost my way, had to backtrack, and sat down to rest, only to wake up to find I'd lost most of the afternoon. It was dusk when I saw the lights of Sævar, the port where I could finally, I hoped, catch the ferry to McKinney's. But when I arrived in the port, a sign announced that the ferry was closed, all trips canceled until further notice. The wind picked up, cold and wet. I felt deflated. A knight who had impulsively taken up a challenge and galloped into the unknown, only to find his path blocked with thorns. I took out Tora's letter and read it again, puzzled by the things she hadn't said. Then I took out her photograph, which I had brought with me, and it seemed to say everything I needed to hear. Beside the ferry was a dilapidated vessel with peeling paint. First I thought it was empty until I saw a faint glow and heard the wet suckle of an indrawn pipe. A chair scraped back, an oil lamp flared to life, and I found myself looking into a pair of pale eyes that fixed on me like an owl's. I hailed him and asked, "Do you know why the ferry has been canceled?" "The wind's crosswise was his short reply. "I need to get to McKinney's," I said. "My name is Callum MacLeod." "Jacob Gunnarsson," he replied, "I could take you." "Will you do it for £20? He nodded. When he stepped out of the darkness of the covered deck, I saw him clearly for the first time. There was something wrong with his face. A deep scar ran from his cheekbone to the edge of his mouth. He saw me looking and said, "A puffin gave me this when I pulled her from her burrow. The gannets only peck you." He rolled up the sleeves of his sweater, and I saw that his forearms were covered with small white scars. "I don't climb the cliffs," he said. "I gather the dead birds from the sea and get a tenth share." "I'm a Guga man myself," I said. He looked at me with a raised eyebrow. "Are you now?" As I handed him a 20-pound note, I asked, "Do you live here in Sævar or on McKinney's?" Gunnarsson replied, "I would not live on McKinney's for all the cod in the North Sea." "Why not?" He shrugged. "Not many people alive now," he said. "Most are dead." Like McKinney's, my own island was steadily losing its population as young people chose to leave, like me and Esbern, except that Esbern had gone back. I climbed aboard, and Gunnarsson banged on the engine, which stuttered to life. He removed the ropes attached to the cleats and settled into the controls, gunning the boat past the inert ferry and the steep slopes along the fjord. As soon as the boat shot out into the open sea, a huge wave dashed against it, pushing it crosswise so that I almost fell overboard. Once I wiped the salt water out of my eyes, I saw that we were aimed toward a tall, dark mound of an island. Clouds circled the crown of its hulking mass. I felt a deep chill as the cliffs of McKinney lurched toward us. The boat pitched wildly as we approached, as if reluctant to go to the island. Gunnarsson brought the vessel around, lined it up with a narrow cleft, and shot through it in a burst of spray. Breakers hissed over boulders that formed a small beach. Gunnarsson pulled the boat alongside a steep concrete staircase, and I climbed out onto the lowest step. The cliffs soared high above my head, their crowns disappearing into mist that thinned and thickened in the erratic wind. I felt a wave of vertigo. "Wait," I called to him, "when is the next ferry?" "Maybe tomorrow, maybe never," he grinned, and on his scarred face the grin was a grimace. "Who knows, maybe you'll decide to stay. Tora is very beautiful." He whipped the boat around, lurched through the cleft, and was gone. I called after him but got no reply. What could I have said, even if he had turned around? Did he know about Torah's letter? Did he know why I was here? Whose side was he on? I took a shaky breath and began climbing. Birds screamed from their narrow perches as I passed. Mist ribboned off the dripping walls. From the dark cliffs to my left came a low grating sound, like the giant door of an ancient castle creaking open. A dark shape hurtled toward me, and I slipped and fell back a few steps, twisting my ankle. The dark shape took the form of a chunky bird with a round belly and stubby wings. It skittered through the air, tumbled by the wind before it leveled out and dived toward the sea. A puffin, a bird I once thought comical until I saw Jacob's ruined face. I put a little weight on my ankle, tested it, and found I could walk. I hobbled up until I reached the top of the steps. The concrete gave way to a turf path that continued in an upward slope through dense mist. I couldn't see a village. I couldn't see 10 feet ahead of me. The mist thinned, revealing steep-roofed wooden houses clustered along the narrow path, like Brigadoon emerging from its 100-year sleep. As I passed a whitewashed church, the door opened and a kerchiefed woman emerged with her back to me, sweeping dirt across the lintel. "Excuse me," I said, "can you direct me to the home of Torah Magnusson?" She turned, startled, and I wondered if she spoke English. Then she gestured up the road and walked quickly back inside and shut the door. I waited for a minute in case she came out again, perhaps having taken off her apron and removed her kerchief the way housewives on Lewis did to make themselves presentable for visitors. But no one emerged from the church, and all around me the village was silent. Unnaturally so. Not a single person was in the streets. I heard no voices, no sound of hammers or engines. The only sign of life was the flutter of a curtain in a second-story window and a brief glimpse of a face that was quickly withdrawn. The wind whipped around me as if pushing me uphill in the direction the woman from the church had indicated. I let it push me past doors that remained closed and windows shuttered until I came to the last house in the village, a long two-story wooden house with gable end roofs tucked under a steep roof. Gable and rooms tucked under a steep roof. Light glowed in the windows. The front door opened and a young woman appeared on the threshold. She was tall and willowy, and her shoulder-length hair glinted with copper and gold. It was Torah, even more beautiful than the photograph. I found it difficult to breathe. "I knew you'd come," she cried, and ran to greet me, her eyes glistening with tears. I asked, "Have you found Esbern?" She shook her head and led me inside to a small mudroom where I shed my boots. Beyond this, a dark hallway led farther into the house, past a steep staircase. At the end of the hall, we entered a large room with a stove on one side and a fireplace on the other, a combined parlor and kitchen. Large windows let in the dying light of day. An old woman was bent over the stove, stirring a pot. "This is my mother," said Torah. The woman turned slowly toward me. The beauty she had shared with her daughter in the photo was now gone. She looked gray, too ill to be standing in a kitchen cooking. She covered her mouth, barely concealing a ragged cough. "Esbern's friend," she croaked. I shook hands mechanically, but in my mind I saw the middle-aged, stolid Gudrig speaking so sensibly in the dining room of the wave-tossed boat, streaming north from Copenhagen. I knew Esbern's mother. I was very sad when she died. The reporter inside of me gave me a kick, and I stammered, "On the Childur I met a friend of yours, a woman named Gudrid. She said..." My voice died. Torah's mother was obviously alive. I knew from my own island community how rapidly rumors spread. An illness on one side of the island in the morning became death on the other by night. "My mother's been quite ill," said Torah. "Please sit by the fire while I put her to bed. I also need to check on my father, then we'll talk." Torah took her mother's arm, but the woman didn't budge. In a low voice, Torah said something in Faroese, and the mother's resistance disappeared, but not before she gave her daughter a look that startled me. A look of pure hatred. Torah soon returned and joined me by the fire. I knew you would come, she said again. Her long-fingered hands rested lightly on her knees, a few inches from mine. Her skin glowed with health, and her brilliant eyes looked into mine with the same intensity I remembered from her photograph. I took the letter from my breast pocket. Attached to it was my who, what, where, when, how, why list, which suddenly struck me as extremely juvenile. I was a boy playing at being a reporter, a peasant masquerading as a knight, and I hastily stuffed it back into my pocket. I asked what I thought was the most critical question. Why would your brother go missing? I asked. She took the letter and blushed. I was so desperate I didn't even know if this letter would reach you. It was like inserting a note in a bottle and throwing it into the ocean. She drew one hand through her thick hair and said, You have to understand how things are here, Mr. McLeod. My heart thumped against my breastbone. Please call me Callum. Callum. The word sounded like caramel on her tongue. Callum, my brother hated Mikins. When he was accepted at Oxford, he let everyone know how glad he was to leave. He returned when Mother became ill, but he didn't settle, and the villagers resented him. They said he had a lot of money but refused to share. There were rumors he was having an affair with the wife of a fisherman. Then 2 weeks ago, the village held its usual gannet hunt. Esbern had written to me from Oxford that you also hunted gannet, so you know what that involves. Esbern joined them that night. It was one thing he couldn't refuse, but he never came home. That's when I wrote you the letter. I think I was half out of my mind with worry. 2 weeks ago? Did he fall? Did the men search? They say they search, but I don't believe them. She took my hand, and her eyes were fierce. I would have gone down myself, but women aren't allowed. My mind reeled. Surely the authorities. What authorities? The authorities on the island are all villagers. They won't let me leave. They screen my mail. I was only able to get the letter to you through Jacob Gunnarsson. Gunnarsson? The man who brought me across? Her hand tightened around mine. He's been expecting you. He's been waiting at Servagore for a week. She hesitated and lowered her eyes. Before his face was torn apart by a puffin, we were engaged to be married. The man's gruesome face rose up before me. I imagined Tora kissing the ruined mouth, and my stomach twisted. Why didn't he take you away from McKinnon's? Her touch turned soft, and once again her eyes filled with tears. How could I leave my parents? How could I abandon my brother without knowing what happened to him? Please, you're my only hope. You know how to climb down the cliffs after Gannet. You can look for him. I stood up, pulling my hands from Tora's. It was difficult to think when I sat close to her. I knew what she had done to get Gunnarsson to carry her letter. She was offering me the same bribe. I felt sick. I pushed the turbulent thoughts away and focused on Esbern. 2 weeks. Could a man survive on a ledge for 2 weeks? He would have rainwater to drink, raw gannet to eat, and a lifetime's experience dealing with cold and wind. If a fire could be coaxed from old bones and oily feathers, Esbern would be the man to do it. I felt a stirring of hope. Can you signal Gunnarsson? I asked. Have him bring his boat to the bottom of the cliffs, where the hunt was held? And a rope. I need a long rope to climb down and look for him. Then carry him down to the sea where Gunnarsson can take us both to safety. I spoke quickly, my mind racing. If it weren't night, with a howling storm roaring through the dark outside, I would have insisted we leave immediately. Tora listened to me, nodded, smiled, and even clapped her hands. All this is possible, she said when I paused for breath. You are a good friend to Esbern. He will be eternally grateful, and so will I. She insisted that I eat supper with her so that we would gain strength for the next day. I was too excited to eat, but I sat with her as she brought a tray to the table. On it were 10 tiny bird bodies, the fat round shapes of puffins, stuffed with dough and raisins. Tora ate 5. After supper, she led me upstairs. The second floor was divided into 2 rooms. She opened the door to one of the rooms. It contained a single bed, covered with a thick quilt, a table with a lamp, and an empty wardrobe. She gestured across the landing to the other room. I keep a cot in my parents' bedroom so that I can take care of them during the night. She stepped close to me and tilted her head up as if she expected me to kiss her. When I made no move to do so, she said, "Good night, then," a little coldly, and disappeared into her parents' room. A sound awakened me in the night, a faint whimper and cry. I decided it was the wind and went back to sleep. The next morning I woke to the smell of coffee and freshly baked bread. I dressed and came downstairs to the parlor and kitchen. Sunlight streamed through the windows. "A good day for hunting," came the cheery voice of Tora. "I hope my father didn't wake you during the night. It was one of his bad spells." "It must be very difficult for you," I said as I sat down at the table. "Oh, I don't mind." She set a cup of coffee and three rolls in front of me. Her eyes were gray as mist, her hair a constantly shifting swirl of amber, gold, and copper. I would rather they were with me than in the cold ground. Her fingers brushed mine, sending electric shocks up my arm. "Did you signal Gunnarsson?" I asked. She nodded. "He should be at the bottom of the cliffs in a couple of hours." As soon as breakfast was over, we set out. The wind was brisk and tugged at our jackets as we walked uphill. As we crossed over a narrow bridge to reach the cliffs, where the gannet hunt was held, I glanced back and saw someone following me. I felt a stab of fear. Was it one of the villagers? One minute we had sun, then rain, and now a thick, absorbent fog swallowed us. The figure became a dark shadow and then faded away. I said nothing to Tora, not wanting her to worry. Tora suddenly brought her hand to my chest to stop me. As the fog dispersed, I found myself at the edge of a cliff looking down at nothing. I fell to my knees and crawled to the edge. Hundreds of feet below, a gray-green ocean boiled. All my fears of heights returned in full force, but I couldn't look away. Pockets of mist danced around narrow ledges covered with guano, nests, and white birds. A few birds had not yet shed their mottled coat of white and brown feathers. The gannet chicks slow to leave the nest, not yet able to fly. The sea crashed white against the glistening black skin of basalt boulders at the base of the cliff. The wind boiled up from below, blasting tears from my eyes. I could see no sign of a boat. Where was Gunnarsson? A few feet away, Tora stood at the edge of the cliff beside a large iron stake driven into the turf. A rope was tied to the stake in a slipknot and piled in a thick coil beside it. She grunted as she pushed and pulled the pile to the edge of the cliff, and my brain screamed with horror, for a woman to touch the gannet rope was taboo. With a sound like birds taking flight, hundreds of feet of thick rope slithered across over the edge of the cliff and down. The rasping sound died away and the rope hung taut. Behind us, caught in the wind that surged over the rugged landscape, came the cry of someone calling my name. I looked back. A shadow labored up the steep trail behind us. It was Tora's mother. "Quick," said Tora. "She'll try to stop you." I stepped to the edge of the ledge, gripped the thick rope, and walked down the cliff with my face to the sky and my back to the boiling ocean below. I kicked off the cliff face and slid down the rope, falling several feet at a time before tightening my grip and stopping my fall. I noticed that the rope was frayed. Bits flaked off in my hands. From what Esbern had told me, the rope was always taken home after the hunt. A man got an extra share to store it and keep it oiled and ready for the next year. This rope had been abandoned. The basalt slid past my face, 2 feet away when I kicked off, then 6 inches as I swung close. I was giddy with fear and excitement. A new feeling grew in me the farther down I went. I felt strong, brave, and powerful. I was master of wind and stone, hunter of gannets. My feet touched down on several ledges, too narrow for a man to stand or lie on. The ledges were slippery with the only oily residue of the gannet's feathers and excrement. The birds ate squid and fish, and the oil permeated their flesh and drenched their feathers, which helped them stay dry when they dived into the ocean. About 40 feet down, I landed on a ledge that jutted out 3 feet from the rock wall. 6 feet from where I landed, a white bird with black-tipped wings emerged from a tangled nest, leaped into the wind, and plummeted down toward the sea below. 2 smaller birds, still decked with their juvenile plumage, fought each other over something on the ledge. I edged closer and almost fell off. They were fighting over a human skeleton. A few scraps of clothing clung to shredded bits of skin, and I recognized an ugly plaid shirt that was one of Esbern's favorites. I had often used it as my prime example of his atrocious taste in fashion. The top of the body was intact, but the leg bones were splintered. He might have survived the fall and been alive for a while. After what seemed like an age, I heard Tora's voice far above me. "Callum, are you all right? Have you found him?" My tongue was dumb, but fury swept through me. I grabbed the rope and climbed back up. When she saw the look on my face, she stepped back. "Callum, what's the matter?" "What's the matter?" I repeated. Tora stepped to the edge, looking down. "You found him, didn't you? Why didn't you bring him up?" "For God's sake, Tora," I grabbed her arms. "Why did you lie to me? How long ago did he fall? That body's been there far longer than 2 weeks."
2 years, she said. Her eyes were bright and fierce. I wasn't holding a trembling swallow, but a sharp-taloned eagle. And then her eyes swiveled from mine and fixed on a point behind me. Her eyes grew wide. I turned to look. The rope hanging over the edge was moving, not from the wind, but in the jerky manner of a rope being climbed. Someone was climbing up from below. The skeletal fingers first appeared, then the skull with its gaping eye sockets and flaps of skin still hanging from the lips and nasal passages. I could hear breathing, a hollow, rasping sound. The fingers grasped at the thick turf into which the stake was pounded. Slowly they pulled the rest of the body over the lip of the cliff, onto the wild grass, only the arms still fully articulated and functioning, the shattered legs and pelvis useless but still hanging off the bones with tendons. The head turned toward me, and the mouth twitched under open over yellow teeth. "Callum," said the bones of Esbern. The voice rasped and tore through my body. The eye sockets glowed as if infected with luminescent fungi. Then the thing turned its attention to his sister. "Tora," grated the voice.
"Esbern," she cried, sobbing, and ran forward. The fingers gripped her ankles and pulled her off balance. She toppled and fell, sliding off the moist grass and slippery stone. I crawled to the edge in time to watch them fall. The bones of Esbern were wrapped around her, the ragged plaid shirt flying out behind him as the two bodies fell together, one very much alive and kicking, the other, I now realized with a shudder, about to experience his second death. They must have kicked away from the cliff face, because they missed the ledge on the way down, as well as the boulders at the bottom. They fell directly into the sea, a tiny splash that grew into a bloom of white ripples that spread out in the shape of a rose. Gunnarsson's boat was nowhere in sight. Tora had lied to me about that, too. She had never signaled him, never intended her brother to leave Mykins. I drew back from the edge and wept. I cried for my friend, and maybe a little for the Tora of the photograph. When I opened my eyes, I was startled to see Tora's mother sitting a few feet away, stony-faced and tearless. In her arms, she held a burlap bag. Something in it moved and whimpered. Cold chills ran down my spine. Her lips curled in the kind of smile favored by wolves. "The men of my kinds have long lived by a certain code," she said. "If one of their own falls from the cliffs and is broken, they agree to throw him into the sea so that if he is a Draeger, he will drown and die a second death, the death in which he dies forever. It's a terrible curse to live again if you die hunting gannets." She opened the bag. A rotten stench gushed out, and I gagged and turned away, but not before I saw ribs that stuck through the flesh, the crushed pelvis, the smashed leg bones. My husband fell and was broken, but Tora refused to let the men take him. She cares for his broken bones and rotting flesh in the mistaken belief that she loves him too much to let him die. She did the same for me. When I died of fever 2 years ago, she refused me my second death. "You came to Esbern in a dream," I said, "second sight." From her dry, stony lips, her whispery voice said, "Esbern heard my call for help and returned, but she pushed him off the cliff rather than let me die forever. In her mind, she would nurse the three of us through eternity. When Tora murdered her brother, the Gannet hunters stopped hunting. They left the rope
and we were severed from the community. The words of Jacob Gunnarsson came back to me. I would not live on Makines for all the caught in the North Sea. Most are dead. Is everyone on Makines a dragor? I asked. She shook her head. Not all. You can usually tell by how beautiful they are. That is what Esbern wanted to study at Oxford. He wondered if being a dragor had to do with something other than genes, perhaps the air or the food of Makines. Maybe if he would get away from the island, the curse would leave him, and he could marry and die a normal death without worrying whether he would come back to haunt those he loved. Such foolishness for a man who studied life. A gene doesn't care about the consequences of eternal life when its only choice is survival or death. I think the beauty of the dragor is a morbid love of life, the rush to live on and on no matter the consequences. I remembered how beautiful Tora's mother was in the photograph before she died. Her first death had diminished her. A second death would extinguish her altogether. A gene for immortality? Weren't there types of jellyfish that could live indefinitely? Perhaps dragor were like cats with only two lives. They had a gene that enabled them to reassemble the life force after a first death. I shuddered at the idea that someday the Makines dragor gene might figure out how to survive this second death as well. I became aware that Tora's mother was still speaking. "Look at me and my husband," she said. "We have wakened to the reality of what it means to live forever, and we are terrified. If you ever meet Tora again, you will find her much less beautiful." Meet her again? My heart leaped at the prospect, at the same time that it shrank. Then I blurted out, "But she's dead." "Is she?" Tora's mother stepped closer to the edge of the cliff, her husband's bones twitching and moaning in the bag she held close to her chest. When Esbern pulled her over the cliff, he went to his second death, but she is only on her first. When you leave Makines, you might want to find a place to live that is far from the sea. And with that, she closed her eyes and stepped into the emptiness. The end. This next story is called The Wind Phone by Josh Pachter. His room at the Sado Inn was simple. Tatami mats on the floor, a sleeping pad, one chair, a sink, communal bathroom down the hall. But it had a narrow balcony that looked out across a quiet two-lane road and the gray sand of Namita Beach to the infinite blue carpet of the Pacific Ocean. The journey from Tokyo Station that Saturday had taken him more than 6 hours, first the long train ride north to Shin Hanamaki, then two hours on the spur line east to Kamashi, a lovely half-hour through the mountains and along the coast on the sleepy old Sanriko Tetsudo Ryasu Railway, and finally a brief stroll to the Ryokan, where the kimonoed innkeeper welcomed him with green tea and wagashi and bowed deferentially to the room he had reserved, using an invented name and paid for with a credit card he knew could never be traced back to him. He sat on the balcony with a bottle of Kirin Ichiban he had purchased from the kiosk on his arrival at the Namitagagon station and looked out at the sea. On his lap was a brochure he had downloaded from the Internet, but he had committed the information to memory even before boarding his first train in Tokyo, so he had no need to refer to it as he considered the history of the Otsuki wind phone. When local designer Itaru Sasaki's cousin died of cancer in 2010, Sasaki bought an old telephone booth, painted it white, and set it up in his garden so he could imagine himself still able to talk with his cousin by phone, their conversations, as he put it, carried on the wind. A year later, after the Tohoku tsunami killed over 15,000 people, more than 1,200 of them right here in Otsuki, Sasaki granted access to his wind phone to the public so that mourners could call friends and family members who had died in the disaster and thereby process their grief. Since then, replicas of the wind phone had been erected in Ireland, Canada, and several American states. But it was Sasaki's original structure that had brought the man, calling himself Hiroshi Watanabe, to Kirikiri Village. He finished his beer and went back into his room, washed his hands, and examined himself in the mirror that hung above the sink. No one had ever accused him of being good-looking, but his regular features were certainly not displeasing. His hair, once black, was shot now with gray, and there were crow's feet at the corners of his narrow eyes. His pupils behind the clear lenses of the glasses that had no effect on his perfect vision, but served only as a basic element of disguise, were obsidian and expressionless. His nose, broken long ago in a fist fight he was immature enough to engage in, was broad and flat, his teeth the best that money could buy. He was clean-shaven, but during the vacation he would allow himself, after his visit to the wind phone, he would regrow the mustache and goatee. The few shopkeepers who knew him in the Acabane neighborhood where he lived would expect to see on his rare visits to their establishments. He had won the fist fight, had sent his opponent to the hospital with multiple facial contusions and two broken ribs, but he was still ashamed of having allowed himself to be goaded out of his usual, even then, years before he had embarked on his current occupation, anonymity. As the sky above the sea began to darken, the man traveling as Hiroshi Watanabe left the inn and crossed the road and descended a flight of stone steps to the beach. It was late November, and there was a chill in the air. He zipped up his poplin jacket and wished he had brought something heavier. At least he had his gloves, and he pulled them on, but they were light cotton and offered little protection from the wind, so he stuffed his hands into the pockets of his jacket. He had the beach to himself at this hour, and he strolled north, wrapped in silence but for the susurration of the wavelets laughing at the sand. He thought of his wife, Katsuko, who, like Itaro Sasaki's cousin, had been taken away by cancer, and of their daughter, Ichika, who had lost her long battle with the Hiyu Yakubutsu and died of an overdose, still a teenager, less than a year after Katsuko's passing. Ichika's name meant 1,000 flowers, and the day after her funeral, he had scattered a packet of white chrysanthemum seeds along the southern bank of the Arakara River, praying that 1,000 blossoms might grow. Perhaps they had. He had never gone back to look, had retreated into the little house that now, with Katsuko and Ichika gone, seemed much too big for a middle-aged man alone. He rarely emerged, except to buy groceries and, three or four times a year, when his employers gave him a mission to complete. He was not traveling in his professional capacity now. This trip to the wind phone, the first time he had left Tokyo in more than a year, was personal. He had learned that there was only one restaurant in the village, but he had no desire to sit at a table alone and be fawned over by some solicitous proprietor. When he returned from the beach, he ducked into the family mart besides the inn and bought a cardboard container of miso soup and another of tonkatsu. There was a microwave in the store, and he warmed up his food and ate it on his balcony with a second bottle of beer. He slept fitfully that night, plagued by nebulous dreams of telephone and talking flowers. Early in the morning, he found a tray outside his door, as he had requested, and breakfasted on his balcony, grazing thoughtfully across the calm waters of the Pacific. 5,000 miles to the east, he knew, lay the city of San Francisco in America. He had never been to America, though he and Katsuko had often promised Ichika, when she was a little girl, that they would take her there some day to see the wonders of the country that had defeated a Japan gone mad in the greater East Asia War. Someday. He chewed his rice, grilled mackerel, tamagoyaka, and pickled daikon without tasting them, saw the sun rise on the far horizon without any appreciation of the palette of colors it painted across the slate gray sky. When he finished his meal, he showered in the bathroom down the hall and dressed himself in the same clothing he had worn on the previous day, navy blue trousers, white turtleneck, pale blue Hanten. At precisely 8:30, he left the inn and walked for 10 minutes across the narrow gauge railway tracks, past Karakuri's tightly packed network of houses and shops, through the narrow tunnel beneath the Sanriku Coast Expressway, and up Chiwari Hill to a point in the trees by the side of the path from which he could observe the glass-paned white booth that housed the wind phone. As he had been informed it would be, the booth was occupied at this hour. According to the information he had received, it was used every Saturday and Sunday morning from 8:30 to approximately 8:45 by the same young man, Shuniki Tanaka, who lived in Tokyo but came north each Friday to spend the weekend in Kirikiri with his widowed mother and speak to his dead father on the wind phone. Shuniki, he thought. The name was uncommon, combining the kanji, jun, meaning pure, with iki, meaning simply one. Pure one. He smiled tightly at the irony of it. The young man was dressed in Western clothing, jeans, a black T-shirt, high-top sneakers. He was hunched over the phone, speaking earnestly, only the back of his shirt visible, but the man traveling as Hiroshi Watanabe assumed that the front bore either the image of a popular American musical artist or some cryptic wasiigo, or so-called English phrase. The last time he had gone grocery shopping in Akabane, he had noticed a girl who couldn't have been older than 15, Ichika's age, the last time he had seen her. Her jet-black hair pulled into long pigtails that jutted out from the sides of her head and fell to her shoulders. She wore a pleated plaid miniskirt and a white T-shirt tied at the waist to shamelessly expose her belly, still puffy with baby fat. On the shirt, in large black letters, appeared the legend, "Do not taunt Happy Fun Ball." He still wondered what on earth those words meant when arranged in that order. He waited patiently for Junichi's Tanaka to finish his call. When the young man finally cradled the phone and emerged from the booth, he saw that there was indeed an illustration of four white-faced men in strange black makeup on the front of the T-shirt. Above the four faces, the word KISS was printed, all in capital letters, the two S's distressingly similar to the insignia of the Nazi Schutzsatzel from the war. He came out from behind the trees and approached the pure one, bowed politely, and then took his gloved right hand from his jacket pocket and held it out in a friendly Western gesture. Tanaka extended his own hand, and the two of them shook. "I hope your conversation brought you peace," the older man said. The young man nodded. "It did, Oji-san," he said, using the polite form of address custom dictated. "May I wish you the same peace I have found?" The man traveling as Hiroshi Watanabe jerked hard on the other's hand and spun the boy around. Releasing his grip, he shifted his right arm and pulled the pure one close to his chest. With his free left hand, he drew a thin blade from its sheath and in a single practiced motion slit Juniki Tanaka's throat. Hot blood spurted from the cut, but the older man's usual technique prevented even a single drop from touching his own clothing or flesh. He let the body drop to the manicured dirt path, and without so much as a second glance, stepped over it and entered the booth. He lifted the receiver from the black Bakelite rotary phone and dialed the number he remembered so achingly well. The phone was connected to nothing, so he heard no dial tone, no ring, no answering. Mashi mashi. But as he spoke into the receiver, he believed with all his heart that the wind phone was granting him one final opportunity to talk with his beloved daughter. "Ichika," he said, and his voice, though tinged with grief, was strong and proud. "I have sent the man who addicted you to the drugs that destroyed you to meet his ancestors. I pray, my little one, that you can at last now rest in peace." He cradled the phone and left the booth, stepped again over the motionless body on the path, and headed down the hill toward the train station. Tomorrow, he promised himself, he would return to the banks of the Arakawa River and count the chrysanthemums. I have about 5 minutes to start another story. This is Knock Knock by Sarah Hillary. "Morning, Mr. Neary." The nurse, I haven't learned her name, bustles about my bed, bullying the blankets into shape. Her starchy hustle exaggerated by her uniform, so aggressively man-made it gives out sharp little zips of static as she touches the bed frame, pressing a broad palm along the sheet under my left side, inspecting for accidents in the night. "How are you this morning?" "Dry," I say. "I think. How would I know?" She hasn't waited for an answer in any case. Busy by the window now, there's a screeching sound of an approaching train as she hauls the blind. Light hammers into the room. I think I groan, but again, who knows? If I did, she didn't notice or doesn't care, her attention fixed outside. A stud in her earlobe flickers on and off, and the light strikes it. The sight of it makes my bowels quaver. The stud itself is inoffensive, but it raises the specter of hollow pendants and lockets, small precious things worn close to the skin, fastened and unfastened by unthinking fingers, perfect hiding places, their intimacy almost unnoticed. I must have made a sound of distress because Nurse Bustle turns to the bed. Now how about some breakfast? She chirps. She's checking the tubes running in and out of me, hollow, touched too often, and the machine that records my progress, or lack thereof, but it is breakfast that's on her mind. Gray eggs and wet toast, squeaky on the way down, sloppy on the way out. I'm a mess, sliced up the middle, stapled down the front. A ribcage cracked and clamped open, veins harvested here and there. Have you been to a harvesting before? The surgeon's initials carved into the plump pink muscle of my heart. Silvered now, stitched back together, but by all means, breakfast. Let that be the order of the day. Never mind the words I've heard her whispering with the surgeon about the operations, more than one, which saved my life. I read like a hardware store, expansively inventoried. A plastic tray on a wipe-clean table is swung across my bed by Nurse Bustle's large, freckled hands that have touched too much already. Everything in the room, myself included. Doesn't she understand that is all it takes? A hollow place in which to hide and the touch of fingers that don't even know they're caressing until it's too late. I must have slept because the next time I look, the blinds are drawn and the room is dark. Time has a habit of running away from me in here. I'll find 10 minutes slipped under the pillow or crouching at the foot of the bed. Those minutes will pass slowly, crawling like ants across the soles of my feet. If I could, I'd cook them away, rise up against my tubes and staples, storm out of here in search of real time. When did I last live in the moment, as my old sensei used to insist? I want to say I can't remember, but of course I can. I remember every step that took me from Kyoto to this hospital bed in Hastings. You'd remember, too. The room is dark, but I'm not alone. Someone is seated at the side of my bed in the high-backed chair that puts a shadow on the floor like a spillage. The first few days spent here, I was convinced it was a stain, expecting a nurse or porter to clean it up. When they didn't, I suspected the hospital of poor hygiene, began to fear an infection to add to my woes. The stain would spread over the course of the day. Eventually, I saw it was the chair's shadow stretching as the sun made its slow way into the room. Time has run away again. I make myself focus on the fact of someone sitting in the chair, so still I didn't see them at first, an undefinable part of the chair's bulk. The chair is a fixture I've relegated to the background, a detail of my room, but not a vital one like the heart monitor and a bedpan. I wish I could ignore it. I have a terrible fear Yoshiko Taro is sitting there, that she has found me. Her face is in darkness, but even in the light, it's black as leather, her eyes sunken holes without color or expression, her mouth a pit guarded by long yellow teeth where her breath hangs sour and wet. Yoshiko Taro. I'm afraid that is the end and all the time I have for today. This is Mary Lee for Talking Information Radio. To be continued next week.